If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Damon Sharonis, he's always here to break down the criminal law with us. He's the founder of Sharonis & Parenti, aggressive, effective advocate for people charged with federal, white-collar violent crimes, all kinds of crimes. Damon, welcome, as always, to the show. How are you?
Hello, Karen. How are you today? Thank you for having me.
And I know you were at the Bruce Springsteen concert, and your voice is telling me that, right?
That's the problem with knowing all the words to the song. yes, that's why I'm struggling today, but I'm getting a little better.
That's okay. Well, you sound just fine. Okay, let's talk about the allegations against FBI. Oh, and by the way, we're joined here today with Adam Alleli. He is a creditor's rights lawyer. He decided to stick around for a half an hour, and he may have some questions for you too. So let's talk about these allegations and the indictment against former FBI director Jim Comey regarding the seashells.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, this should not come as a surprise to anyone who's following the news and following prosecutions by the Department of Justice, but essentially they're charging him with trying to extend a, quote, true threat to President Trump, and that's what he's been indicted for, two counts. And just right off the bat, I do not think this case is going to survive a motion to dismiss on First Amendment grounds. It looks to me, and I think it looks to everybody who looks at it objectively, as more of a politically motivated sort of vendetta indictment, but it's not something that I think is going to withstand any constitutional scrutiny.
So the allegations are that he took a picture. It's not even clear that he actually arranged the seashells. I would imagine he didn't, but something on the beach said 86-47. Which is being construed to mean that there is some call to assassinate President Trump. So you say this is a First Amendment issue. What is the law on when something crosses over the line from your right to say stupid stuff versus a threat to a president?
Sure. You know, under the First Amendment, there's been a lot of litigation on this in the not too distant past. You have to establish an intent to communicate an actual threat that a reasonable person would perceive as serious and dangerous. And the First Amendment protects a lot of speech. It protects speech we don't like. It protects speech that can potentially be scary but doesn't cross that threshold. I mean, I've tried cases in federal court, true threat cases that I've defended. And, you know, here, I don't think they're going to be able to establish that this was anywhere near that. I mean, first of all, 86, I actually, before we even knew, I knew I was coming on the show, I looked up what 86 means and where it sort of came from. And I guess it started out in like the restaurant industry at like soda fountains where people would say like 86 the order. Now, obviously, you know, things can take on different meanings. Pretty vague comment. I don't think he actually put these seashells together. It happened over a year ago or almost a year ago, which courts look at in determining sort of the nature of whether it's perceived as a real threat. Why does it take so long to charge this person? So, I mean, this is something that might not have been in the best taste to put, you know, to blast out on Instagram, but can anybody reasonably say that Comey intended to actually communicate to President Trump that he wanted to assassinate him? It's ridiculous. And think of all the things that have been said by individuals in Donald Trump's party, and I'm pretty much nonpartisan, but that have been said by people in the Republican Party, that if you look at those things in the worst possible light, could be considered true threats. I think this is really way a bridge too far, and any citizen who's concerned about our ability to talk and speak and communicate should really be worried about this.
Well, and today is World Free Press Day. So this is a day that is designated by international people to really honor and preserve the idea that free speech is good. It encourages discussion. It allows people to express themselves in a way to assert their individual rights, to increase public debate, to shed light on government abuses. I mean, it's all good things. I'm just going to quickly go through a few sentences and you tell me why this is a threat or not a threat. Okay, if I say John Smith is such a jerk, he deserves to be shot. Is that a threat?
No, that would probably be protected speech. I mean, there's a situation where somebody is giving more of an opinion. It would depend on the context of it. But I think that that would fall under protected speech, that you're saying something almost hyperbolic. This guy should be shot. This guy should be killed. That's different than communicating the threat that you intend to do something.
Okay. How about John Smith? You better be careful, otherwise you may meet your maker soon.
Yeah, you know, we're moving closer then, right, at that point. I still think you could lodge a pretty significant First Amendment argument that that is more hyperbolic and you did not intend to commit a threat. Now, obviously, context matters and it's important, but there was a case where somebody said about Lyndon Baines Johnson, if they ever make me carry a rifle, the first man I might shoot is LBJ, and that was protected as political hyperbole. So, you know, that's closer to that, I think.
Yeah, that went up to the Supreme Court, I believe.
Yeah.
So Patrick Fitzgerald, who was our U.S. attorney here in Chicago for 11 years, very, very well-respected attorney, he represented Comey in the first indictment, and it looks like he's representing him here. What is the first order of business? What's procedurally will he do, and how quickly will this work?
Well, there's a lot of motions that can be filed. You know, we'll sort of, we can talk about this later, but in the middle of a big First Amendment case with the Broadview 6 here in Chicago. But the first motion they're probably going to file is the motion to dismiss that this indictment is violative of the First Amendment. That's one, that on its face that this threat cannot be considered a true threat and it goes after protected speech. Because speech itself, right, is, you know, has a lot of protections. Now, obviously, so we're clear, you can't say whatever you want. You can't make a true threat. And, you know, I've had cases with abortion clinics, and I've had cases with other sort of significant comments that were made. And under the context of that, juries have found, yeah, this is considered a true threat. But the first step, I think, is to file a motion to dismiss that the charges are violative of the First Amendment. And then after that, there might be a vindictive prosecution motion, things like that, which are harder to prove. But there's going to be a lot of work done. I mean, if I'm Fitzgerald, who, you know, I had cases against when he was in the office here, and a very well-respected lawyer, you know, he's going to also want to get, if he can, text messages, emails, anything within the Department of Justice that sort of shows why these charges were brought. And we filed a motion similar to that recently here in Chicago. And he's going to be looking for that to see if this was completely politically motivated. And in recent, you know, history in this country, those motions have been granted and the government has dismissed certain cases lest they have to turn that stuff over. So that's going to be a real interesting, you know, sort of motion practice in this case.
And might expose some embarrassing texts going back and forth if they exist. Adam Alalias here. He hung around and he's got a couple of questions pertaining to Comey. Why don't we, Adam, to ask it, Damon your questions? You've got a couple of good ones.
Yeah, sure. Damon, one question is, you know, in a civil case, if there, well, let me ask this differently. Assuming that the prosecution is politically motivated and verging on frivolous, if there's people out there that think maybe this is frivolous, is there any recourse for Comey if he either wins on a motion to dismiss or he wins after trial? Is there any recourse for him to get back at the Department of Justice for bringing the case in the first place?
So, yes. I mean, first of all, it's hard to sue, you know, the Department of Justice, but there is something called the Hyde Amendment, H-Y-D-E. That at least allows individuals, if they can establish the complete frivolity of an indictment, to try to at least get their attorney's fees back, right? So that's one thing that could happen, and you've got to file motions and things like that. We're in the process right now of filing a lawsuit against an ICE agent who shot our client 5 times, and we've got to jump through a ton of hoops that, you know, civil cases don't normally go through. If you're suing Chicago police officers, it's relatively simple. But when you're suing, you know, federal agencies, it's much harder to get through that threshold because they have immunity regarding a lot of things. So it's not like you can necessarily sue the prosecutors for this, but you certainly could at least seek to get money back that you're expending on your attorneys.
Okay, and what's your last question?
So the other question is, if this case, if the Comey case makes it to trial, will President Trump have to appear as a witness and testify that he felt like he was under a threat?
That's an interesting question. And, you know, in a normal case, like cases I've tried where there's threats, they absolutely put somebody on the witness stand to establish that it scared them, that they were in fear. So I guess, you know, the logical answer to that would, although I could see a number of ways how they would try to stop that from happening, could they put on somebody to testify that, objectively speaking, this would scare a president? I think in most threat cases, they would have to do that. Obviously, a president can't be compelled necessarily to testify in a situation like that. So I don't want to give a direct answer whether it's absolutely yes or no, but in your garden variety cases, they absolutely put people on. There was just a case here in Chicago where they called the Cook County judge to testify in a federal courtroom under a true threat case. So the victims almost always take the witness stand.
Okay, thanks.
You know, we've got two things to talk about very quickly. I want to talk about the Broadview 6. Quickly tell our listeners what that is. Your firm is representing them. It's going to trial in a few weeks. I know some charges were actually dropped recently. Can you just give us a rundown of what's going on in that case?
Sure. We represent Brian Straw, who is an attorney and a trustee of the Village of Oak Park, and a great guy who is essentially executing his, practicing his First Amendment rights at the Broadview Detention Center, where he was protesting what was going on with ICE. An ICE vehicle essentially drove into the crowd, and they were being charged with felony conspiracy. The government just dismissed that charge, and now they have to go to trial, basically saying they were trying to impede this officer's entrance. We believe that this case was politically motivated. We filed a lot of motions, but it looks like we're heading to trial at the end of this month.
Let's pivot a little bit to the tragic story of the two police officers being shot about 10 days ago. One officer was killed. It was a guy who had a criminal history. He was out. I believe there was an outstanding warrant for his arrest for not showing up in court or for violating the terms of his electronic monitoring. I'll let you talk a little bit about that. And tragically, the officer was shot and killed, and another officer is in critical condition. We've heard a lot about the blaming going on here. The judge made a mistake. The Safety Act caused this. Let's start with the Safety Act. Does the Safety Act here, and that is the cashless bail system that some people are wildly against, does that have anything to do with why this guy was out of prison?
Well, absolutely. I will say this. If there was no Safety Act, he would have been in jail, almost without a doubt. And I think Judge Like, who I practice in front of, and who I will say is a very respected judge, a fair judge, but if there was no Safety Act, there would have been a significant bond set that he most likely would not have been able to post, and in jail he would have sat.
But the judge still was allowed to detain him. The Safety Act doesn't take away a judge's right to detain somebody, right?
No, absolutely. The Safety Act basically gives the judge the discretion, based on all of the circumstances, to determine whether or not there are any conditions that can be set to ensure the safety of the community and to ensure his appearance in court. So Judge Like, there was a hearing. The state wanted him to stay in. The defense put forth all of this evidence that he was taking college classes and all of these other things. And the judge made a decision based on his discretion that he was going to give this individual an opportunity to be released on electronic monitoring. And, of course, second-guessing this, was it the right decision? I think we can all agree this individual probably should have been in jail pending the outcome of his trials. I don't want to put myself in Judge Like's shoes when those arguments were being made. And always thoughtful, but it's just horrible. Whenever you have a system where individuals are going to be released on bond, horrible things are going to happen. And this is one of the worst things you can imagine. Two Chicago police officers doing their job, you know, keeping the street safe, end up in this situation. It's horrific.
And there was an issue. My understanding is there was a violation or a potential violation of his electronic monitoring. I think I'm right about that, and that there was a warrant out. And it seemed that the warrant came out maybe 6 weeks before the shooting. My question is this, just in your experience, Damon, the sheriffs go out and serve these warrants. So if there's a violation, they have to go out and get the person and detain them and deal with that violation. How long does that take? Is there a process for expediting these arrests? Tell us how that works.
But I think it depends, right? Oftentimes, you know, people are very hard to find, right? You know, you have individuals who, if you're on electronic monitoring and you live gone and you're no longer where you're staying, I mean, they've got to find them. And I don't know if they have the resources to do manhunts for these people. Oftentimes, warrants get executed when somebody gets pulled over for a traffic violation, and oh, they run their license and they have a warrant. So it's a very imperfect system. 6 weeks is a long time. You can imagine all of the work the sheriffs have to do with all the people that they have to execute warrants on, not just individuals who have violated their EM. So it's a completely imperfect system. And a lot of judges, I've seen judges who basically have said to me and some of my clients, we're not going to release these individuals because we don't trust electronic monitoring. We don't think that that does what it's supposed to in order to keep the community safe. In a perfect world, once somebody violates their bond, there's a warrant executed and they get arrested in short order. But that's just not the reality of it.
I have one last question about the Jim Comey case that was spurned by a texter who just texted in on this. Let's just say that this is a political prosecution. But, you know, the question is, aren't all prosecutions political in that prosecutors have a lot of discretion in whether they charge somebody or not? So they could say, you know, I'm going to charge this person because I want to set an example because it's a high profile person and I want people to know they can't threaten the president. Let's just say that's a motivation. Is there anything wrong with that kind of thought process? And is that an illegal prosecution based upon choosing something because it's going to send a message?
No, I mean, I think what you have to think about and how you have to look at it is, yes, prosecutors have enormous discretion. They decide who to charge and what to charge, and oftentimes they choose high-profile defendants and they bring these aggressive cases. But when it stops sort of being about the evidence and starts looking like you're, you know, punishing somebody for exercising a legal right, somebody who's spoken out publicly, somebody who has given the president a hard time, and there's weak or thin evidence, and you can find some sort of pattern, emails, texts, statements from the Department of Justice or the Trump administration showing an intent to punish, then you're getting much closer into an improper motive. And it's very hard to show that because prosecutors can be aggressive, but they can't be retaliatory. That's when sort of discretion becomes unconstitutional. So it's really a fact-driven issue, and what can you find? Right. If you were to find an email or a text from somebody in the Trump administration saying, hey, go find a crime to charge Comey with, and then this happens, well, that's a pretty clear-cut case of vindictive prosecution. You usually don't find smoking guns like that. But, you know, you have a case that I think is very weak. You have a defendant who is a political nemesis of the president, right? So you have the perfect storm for a vindictive prosecution. How will they get that evidence out? Can they? It's possible. And, you know, I think, I don't want to give my opinion, you probably know what it is, but there's a lot of other crimes going on in this country that deserve the attention of the Department of Justice, who already have limited resources. And if you're going after somebody like this for a post on Instagram that isn't even directly a threat, you know, it gets pretty close to improper motives. Now, hey, I wasn't sitting in the room, but, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to watch this play out.
And just one final comment from a texter, and we only have a minute. There was just an article in the Tribune. I did see that this morning. It talked about, I think it was McLean County. They did a study on, since the Safety Act, that more people are being detained. Judges are more frequently detaining people pre-trial, given the fact that they have deemed them to be of danger to the community or a flight risk. And it had the opposite effect of what people are saying, which is we're releasing everybody willy-nilly. Can you address that, and what are your thoughts about that?
Sure, and we've talked about this. Absolutely, it is much harder to get certain defendants out than it used to be because judges don't want to end up on the cover of the Tribune. Judges don't want to end up, you know, in political trouble, and they say, "Well, you know, I'm not going to let somebody violent out on the streets." Where in the past they would set a bond, and the bond might be $750,000, and you have to post $75,000, and most people couldn't get out. But I think the criminal defense bar as a whole has found it much more difficult to get individuals charged with serious crimes of violence out than before the Safety Act.
Damon Charonis, thank you so much for joining us with your Bruce Springsteen concert voice. Thank you for being a trooper. How can people reach you if they have a serious criminal problem?
Sure. My website, it's firm of Charonis and Parenti, and it's Charonis Law, CHERONISLAW.com, and you can just ping me on that.